We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to the second program of Examining Education. My name's Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley, and I will be the host and producer of what we hope will be a long series of programs on education that will focus on those issues that provoke much debate. Today's program focuses on school funding. We're asking whose responsibility it is currently to fund public education and whose responsibility it should be. Our distinguished guests for this program include Ralph Mortieri, Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, Henry M. Levin, Director of the National Center for the Study of Privatization and Education at Columbia University, and Walter McMahon, Professor of Economics and Professor of Educational Organization and Leadership at the University of Illinois. Before turning to our first guest, Ralph Mortieri, let me give you a thumbnail introduction to our topic. In our last program, we discussed who was responsible for public education. That subject required us to talk about three levels of government: the federal, the state, and the local district. We learned that the state has the major responsibility for providing education, but the district has the major responsibility for actually administering our schools. We learned that the federal constitution makes no explicit mention of education. It wasn't until 1867, with the establishment of the Department of Education, that the federal government became actively involved in the schools. Until the last few years, it's been a relatively minor player in the equation. The allocation of responsibility for funding public education reflects a similar division. School districts currently have three sources of formal funding: the state, the local district, and the federal government. In general, the state provides the largest percentage of funds, local districts the next largest, and the federal government the smallest percentage. Nationally, the average breakdown is states 47%, districts 44%, and the federal government 9%. Illinois, however, stands out as being among all 50 states the one state in which the heaviest burden for paying for its schools falls on its local districts. In Illinois, the local districts are responsible for a whopping 59% of school funding. Across the nation, districts generally raise funds for schools through property taxes. Because in every state there's a great disparity between those districts that are well off and have a large tax base and those districts that are poor and have few resources, the result is inequity among school districts. Illinois, it turns out, is also known as the state with the greatest inequity among its school districts. In 2007, the Illinois State Board of Education, looking at figures across 892 school districts, found that the smallest amount spent by a poor school district in Illinois is less than $5,000 per student, and the amount spent by a wealthy school district is over $22,000 per student. Here today to talk to us about the current state of school funding, both statewide and nationally, is Ralph Mortieri, Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. Ralph, before we begin, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, I don't know that I matter that much, but my organization's bipartisan, and so we're a 501c3. We try to take a data-based approach when we analyze these sophisticated tax policy, budget policy, funding policy issues, because at the end of the day, there's really not a Democratic or Republican way to accomplish a lot of these things. You either get it done the right way or you don't. And so we try to take a data-based, best practices, evidence-based approach to these big problems and say, look, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, you ought to be supporting this. And so that's our bailiwick and our approach. We send all our stuff out for peer review with independent economists that are sort of left and right leaning both, and we come up with our analysis that way.
Can you tell us why the percentage paid by the state is so low in Illinois as compared to the other states?
The state's fiscal system hasn't been adequate to fund even a base level of public services for at least 25, 30 years now. And so if you look at Illinois' tax policy, it really is deplorable. It doesn't match any of the principles you need to have tax policy work in a modern economy. So for literally three decades now, after you adjust for inflation and population growth, revenue at the state level isn't enough to continue maintaining the prior year's level of public services. That's a real problem in a state like Illinois, which is a large population state, fifth largest population, large capacity state. We have the fifth largest economy and 13th greatest per capita income, but rank 43rd in spending. So we're coming nowhere near in our general fund meeting any of the existing needs based on the population of our state, and our revenue system did not even support that low level of funding. So for generations, rather than the state putting in an adequate portion of education funding, it really devolved that responsibility down to local governments and the local property tax, so that now Illinois is the single most reliant state on property taxes in the entire country to fund schools. As you noted in your discussion setting forth how school funding is covered, state, federal, local resources, if you significantly over-rely on that local resource, there's such a wide range of property wealth from community to community that only those schools that have really high property wealth have the capacity to fund an adequate education. All other school districts are going to suffer if the state can't put in enough to make education funding adequate and their local resources can't make up the difference.
It sounds as though this problem goes beyond just funding schools, but has there been any attempt to address the problem of this inequity among districts?
Well, you know, the attempt to make funding more equitable among schools is actually buried within the school funding formula itself. We have a formula that is supposed to account for differences in local property values and have the state make up for the fact that in a lower income or a middle income community, property values won't generate as much revenue as you will get in a more affluent community. But the formula itself, well, probably okay, maybe a B-minus type of formula. So it could work fairly well. It won't work at all if it's underfunded. And so that's been where the state has fallen down. The basic beginning education funding point is something called the foundation level, and that's a minimum amount per kid that is supposed to be spent across the state. The foundation level includes things like the basic cost of in-classroom instruction plus the basic cost of building maintenance, that kind of thing. Now, if you set your foundation level too low, which our state historically has and in fact always has, then there is no true equalizing happening under the formula because you're only going to bring school districts that don't have local property values that are sufficient to fund schools adequately up to an inadequate level because your basic starting point is inadequate. And that's been the problem. So it's not really a formula-driven problem in as much as it is a capacity, a fiscal capacity problem. The state doesn't have the resources to fund an adequate level of education, so it sets its foundation level artificially low, so its equalizing process under the formula cannot adjust for the differences in property values.
Well, are there any other states that you think would be models for Illinois?
Well, you know, it's not really that you need a radically different model. Would I adjust the formula? Yeah, I might adjust the formula a little bit. I don't think that it adequately accounts for the poverty adjustment and the poverty adjustment levels. I think that there are things like hold harmless provisions that are antiquated and anti-economic that should be done away with. So, I mean, there's tinkering around the edges that you would do to fix the formula, but it's not as if another state has a secret model that is significantly better as a model than Illinois. You really got to get to where the Illinois process falls apart, and that's with the amount that's the target for education funding that drives the formula, the foundation level. If you have an inadequate foundation level, it doesn't matter if you have the best model in the world, you're not going to do an appropriate job of funding schools across the state as diverse as Illinois. So it really comes to that. And the General Assembly has the authority to set the foundation level, and it has consistently set the foundation level at a point not at all tied to the actual cost of delivering a quality education, and I'll get into that in a second, but rather at a cost that the state deemed it could afford. Now, that's the driving problem, because the state revenue system can't afford to fund schools to an adequate level, an adequate level being defined as evidence-based approach to the per-student cost needed to teach children effectively across the state. So that's where it falls down. And you know, some other states certainly have interesting models you may want to look at. For instance, Iowa has a basic dollar amount that every school district gets for every kid, and then there's adjustments thereafter from the property tax. But Iowa doesn't quite have the demographic diversity that Illinois has. It certainly doesn't have the income diversity that Illinois has, so it's not necessarily, you know, that instructive. I mean, you can look at what other states do, but most states have a school funding formula. 38 states, I believe it is, have a school funding formula somewhat similar to Illinois. The only problem with Illinois is it starts at that inadequate foundation level, and that creates a problem everywhere else down the form.
Well, this certainly doesn't sound like it's a good time to get the General Assembly to raise the foundation level, does it?
It doesn't, and especially in light of what they just did in this last veto session with the tax increase. So Illinois has needed a substantial revenue increase for decades now, and they finally passed one, at least at the income tax level, that is up to snuff, but unfortunately they didn't adjust the sales tax base and they didn't quite fix the long-term structural problems in the fiscal system. So because of that, we have this net $7 billion annual tax increase, which funds absolutely nothing as far as increased investment in any public service. And even worse, the new revenue raised under this tax increase, which was accompanied with, by the way, annual spending caps for the next 4 years, isn't going to be enough to even let the state spend to the cap. So they'll have to spend less than the cap. And because under these spending caps, the state put a number of hard costs that you have to pay, that the General Assembly literally has no discretion over. These include things like debt, capital investments that they have to repay, bonds they have to repay, and the pension ramp. Once you account for those hard costs, the only place the state can make cuts is in its general fund operating budget. Well, $9 out of $10 in the general fund go to education, health, human services, and public safety, education being number one in about 35% of the budget. So you can anticipate that over the next 4 years, education funding at best will be somewhat flat in nominal dollars, maybe a tiny, tiny increase year to year. But in reality, after you adjust for inflation, education funding overall will be cut, and there's really no way out of that. So, no, there's no immediate hope for a turnaround on the really key problem in Illinois, which is an inadequate foundation level.
Do you find, on the other hand, there are people who say the schools are wasting the money they get and they don't need any more money?
Yeah, you know, that's nice rhetoric, but it's not reality. I mean, so there's all kinds of data out there that would indicate that to provide an adequate education, the instructional expense per kid, so not even the building maintenance, just the instructional expense per kid, that means what goes into the classroom, teacher salary, teacher assistant salary, academic program, technology, the things that teach a kid, should be in Illinois about $7,400, $7,500 per kid. Our total foundation level is $6,100 per kid. And that includes building maintenance. So we are so far below what it would cost to provide an adequate education from a learning standpoint for children that the system is just not going to perform well. It will have some school districts, you know, with exceptional leadership or exceptional students, whatever, performing well. Some school districts not, but there's not enough money in the system to create predictable, adequate educational outcomes, and that's the problem. And so if the state wants to be serious about it, you have to give schools the capacity to produce the educational outcomes we want. We haven't done that, and so school performance is all over the board, and that's what we should be expecting given our level of investment.
Are you saying that if the state set its level of foundation support high enough, it would then be okay to rely on property taxes?
You don't want to completely eliminate property taxes from the equation. They certainly are a stable revenue source, and in particularly affluent communities, they allow those communities to fund not just a good education, but a world-class education. And And I think that there's really no compelling public policy interest in bringing the top down. I think the compelling public policy interest is bringing the bottom and middle up. So property taxes will always play a role. And you think about some of the basic roles of property taxes you play, capital improvements and capital maintenance projects. Look, if your school needs another building, if it needs to, you know, fix the roof of a building, all that other stuff, that should be primarily funded from your local property wealth and your local property base, absolutely. So property taxes should play a role. It's just like almost your investment portfolio, Elizabeth. You need a balanced portfolio. You want some large caps, some small caps, some real estate, some international, blah, blah, blah. Same with public finance. I mean, you need a mix of revenue sources. And so having some local revenue in there is a real positive thing, and it's a stabilizing thing. I mean, if you want an example of a state that tried to eradicate property taxes and school funding and fell flat on its face after doing it, look at Michigan. You know, Michigan tried to do this. They didn't replace the property tax revenue with enough stable state-based revenue and had all kinds of crises after crises thereafter. So it's really just a question of finding the right balance point. And a lot of that's going to be determined by a different state's demographics and industrial bases, business bases, commercial bases, all those other things. But there's still some parameters. You want the state to assume somewhere between 45 and 50% of the overall cost of funding education. The feds generally pay for about 9% of all education funding, and then you'd like a smaller reliance then on the property tax. And because Illinois has that reversed, and we very much rely on the local property tax as the primary funder, we've effectively tied the quality of the public education a child's going to receive in our state to the property wealth of the community in which the kid lives. That results in us having, you know, some of the greatest disparities of any state from district to district in education funding. And in particular, when you start looking at the demographics of the state, some of the worst racial disparities. I mean, literally our education funding system has resulted in a structural racism when it comes to education funding policy. So well over 80% of the African-American children are in predominantly, if not exclusively, African-American schools. 90% of the white kids are in predominantly, if not exclusively, white schools, and we have the largest funding gap between majority white and majority minority school districts in the country, second largest achievement gap. I mean, a lot of this stuff is traceable to the revenue. So net, 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 we have to fix school funding by bumping up the foundation level to a point where it's enough to provide a quality education everywhere in the state and have the state pay for that bump up, and that would require enhanced state revenue.
What about a larger funding role for the federal government?
You know what? I think you will never get to that, but I do think that there is a larger federal role to play in two significant areas. And number one, special education funding. I mean, the federal government has created a significant unfunded mandate on special education that is imposed on states and from the states down to the local school district level. And that unfunded mandate nationally is just north of $50 billion. So the federal government, if it's going to impose a mandate that school districts do certain things, ought to pay for that mandate. I mean, there's no question about that. That would take a lot of pressure off of local property taxes primarily everywhere in the country, because most states can't even make up the difference in this unfunded mandate from their state-based revenue. That's number one. I think number two is on poverty. And all the data indicate that if you want to get sort of equal academic outcomes between a child who's growing up in concentrated poverty and a child who isn't, they're going to have to spend more on the kid who's growing up in poverty. And the reason you have to spend more is because that kid doesn't have education reinforced at home nearly as well as the kid who's not in poverty. So in most cases, the kid in poverty doesn't have a computer at home, doesn't have books and magazines available at home, doesn't have a parent that's actively engaged in his or her education, may even have an illiterate parent, may even come from a single-parent family household, may not get adequate nutrition, and in fact, most cases does not get adequate nutrition. So there's a lot of issues to overcome that you can do at the school level. And the multiples are anywhere from about 1.59% 1.59 times what you'd spend on a kid that's not in poverty, and you'd spend on a kid in poverty, so to over two. Nowhere in the entire country is the multiplier being applied for poverty up to what the data indicate you need to overcome the problems associated with poverty. So while you get those stories, the statistical outliers of these school districts in poverty that have their children performing well on tests and doing all these other things that we'd like to see them do academically, the vast majority of them don't. In Illinois, the school districts with significant poverty, well over 70% of them, for instance, are not making adequate yearly progress under NCLB. So it would be great if the federal government stepped to the plate and provided a significantly enhanced investment to the states to counter the impact of poverty in educating a child. Those would be the two areas I think the federal government could step to the plate.
What about arguments for privatizing schools?
You know, we've looked at that, and in fact, we're doing a major analysis now that we're not ready to go public with yet because we're still in the data research part of it. But I have to say there's a couple of things that we really need to understand about that. I mean, number one, private schools are very different from public schools in one key area. They can discriminate. Absolutely. They get to pick what kids go to their schools. Public schools cannot discriminate. So if, in fact, you put significantly more resources into privatizing education, what you'll end up with is all the best students will be cherry-picked by the private schools.
Mm-hmm.
Public schools will be left with the great unwashed masses. That's a way to really destroy any chance for the kids who are mediocre to below mediocre to get any sort of quality education. It'll divert way too many resources into the one. And number two, it will have to be that way, and the data indicate that, because literally if you're in the private school, you are profit motivated. Now, if you're profit motivated, you have two choices in how you make yourself an attractive destination for parents to put their kids. You have to demonstrate that your kids are performing well, right? That's how you sell. Look at our academic performance. Look at our kids on the test. Look at this. Look at that. So you've got to have strong performance. There are two ways to get to strong performance. Number one, get really good kids that are going to perform well. Or number two, find a better way to teach than currently is available so that you can bring kids that are low performers up. Awful expensive and difficult and a lot of uncertainty about finding that better way to teach. Easy to identify those kids that are probably going to do well and get them in.
Well,
so the system itself, it would be jury-rigged to have the private schools cherry-pick. And that's, in fact, what we have found. So the data indicate, I don't know if you've read Diane Ravitch's book.
Definitely.
But, you know, Diane said that's exactly what happened with charter schools. They creamed the best kids out of a neighborhood and then tried to claim that they were doing a better job. Well, they weren't. Those kids would have done well in the public schools. And I think one of the most comprehensive studies of comparing public and private school performance with kids was done by the Lubienskis. It's a married couple of PhDs at the University of Illinois that analyzed this exact question for the Bush administration, the George W. Bush, most recent Bush administration. And what they found was, sure, in the abstract, if you just look at raw data, the private schools outperform the public schools in test scores. The second you adjust for demographics, income level, and race, public schools outperform the private schools. So it's not a panacea, and I think it would lead to some really problematic outcomes. What we have to do is make adequate investments in a public education that's available to every child in a situation where the child can't be discriminated against when they're coming in. And discrimination could be for non-racial, non-income reasons, could just be for capacity reasons, and private schools have every right to do that.
Thanks, Ralph, for giving us a really clear picture of the current state of education funding, with a particular focus on Illinois. And thanks also for pointing to actions you think would lead to a more equitable and effective schools. This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. We've just heard Ralph Martiri, director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, arguing that the way to improve school funding, at least in Illinois, and gain more equity for students, is to restructure the current tax system so that the state can increase the percentage of money it contributes to the schools and raise the foundation level of state support for individual students. He also wants, and this would apply to every state, to require the federal government to fund the various mandates they impose on education, as, for example, their requirements for special ed. There is another point of view argued by people who want government to get out of education. They argue that we've tried government funding of education, and it doesn't work. They say schools are getting more and more money and a greater percentage of the state's budget, and yet the students in these schools are becoming less and less well-educated while they cost the state more and more money, at this point eating up about 35% of state funds. They argue that privatizing schools and creating a free market system would lead to better, less costly, or more efficient and more equitable education. Our next guest on our program is an expert on arguments for and against privatizing education and on the economics of paying for such systems. After taking early retirement from Stanford University, Henry M. Levin went to Columbia University, where he's currently director of an institute he began, the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education. He's also co-director of the Center for Benefit Cost Studies in Education. Thanks so much for agreeing to be a guest on our program, Professor Levin. Before I start firing questions at you, can you tell us a little about yourself and your work?
I'm an economist. I have a PhD in economics, and I've specialized in the economics of human resources and especially education. This field has many dimensions, but one of the central ones is trying to improve efficiency in the use of resources in producing education, looking at investment returns to human capital for particular kinds of education, and financing of education and its consequences.
Can you tell us about the range of models we have for privatizing the funding of our schools?
There are two basic models. The one that's probably best known is the educational voucher. And the educational voucher arrangement is one in which the government would pay for education because of its importance in creating a democratic society and preparing people for democratic institutions to work together, and, of course, to ascertain that everyone can participate in education. At the very least, the funding shouldn't be an obstacle. But where it differs is the assumption that the government, while funding education, should not be producing directly education. Instead, the production would go to the marketplace. And in the marketplace, schools would compete for students. They would receive a voucher for each student that they could redeem with the treasury of the state to get the funding. There would be some restrictions on them because, obviously, to meet the requirements of preparing people for a democratic society, they would have to do some things in terms of their curriculum, perhaps in terms of specific subjects, in terms, perhaps, of particular approaches that they use to ensure that people are prepared to be citizens, prepared to work in the economy and to understand economic institutions and also social institutions. But beyond that, any school could emerge meeting the requirements to be approved, to be eligible, to receive a voucher, and then they would compete for students. And so the argument of the voucher advocates is that this would be a more efficient way for providing education in a number of ways, the first being to match students and to match family preferences more closely to what individual schools do, and the second, because of the competition in the marketplace for students. So the incentive to offer good programs and to compete effectively and to abandon things that aren't working where
that the major model, or are there other models?
There are other models, but it's kind of, let's call it the major conceptual model, because it really covers education at all levels. And when I compare it with the other model, the other main model, you'll see quite a large difference. I should also add that we do have voucher programs in Milwaukee. We've had one in Milwaukee since 1990, so this is perhaps the 21st year. We've had one in Cleveland, I believe, since 1995, so that would be 16 years. We've had one in Washington, D.C. for 3 years, and it has, I think, one additional year to go before it will be passing on. That was an experimental program, and perhaps the results didn't justify the continuing of the program, although that's very controversial among the advocates and the detractors. So we've had the voucher programs, and where you see more of it, where you see it expanding, actually, is in special education. There are at least 5 or 6 states that now offer special education vouchers that parents can take anywhere they want within the limits of the size of the voucher to get their children education. The alternative is what is called a tuition tax credit. And the tuition tax credit basically provides a write-off at the bottom of the tax return. That's why it's a credit, for either some portion of tuition or some maximum amount that you can obtain by sending a child to a private school. There is at least one state that has a tuition tax deduction in which you can treat it as a deduction as you treat your mortgage interest and other deductibles on the state tax. But the tuition tax credit is more common because, you know, at the end of the year, so to speak, for each child in a private school, you get a certain amount directly off the tax burden that you would otherwise owe. Why are they so different, and why do people see them as different? Well, for one reason, you still have a goal of trying to get competition. And that argument is made even for tuition tax credits, saying that now introduce people into the marketplace. But the tuition tax credit is preferred by libertarians and really people with strongly conservative political views, because it's just a change in the tax code. It doesn't get into education per se. Whereas the voucher plan does require that schools be eligible, that schools be approved by meeting certain kinds of standards in order to be eligible for the voucher. And so libertarians and other conservatives don't like the notion that the government can set standards for private schools. They want private schools to have complete autonomy.
All of this, though, still involves public funding. On our first program, Andrew Coulson mentioned a situation in Florida that involved corporations in providing the funding. Are you familiar with this program?
Yes. That actually goes something like a tuition tax credit, only it's the funder who is able to deduct that from the tax bill. And so that's why, in that particular case, businesses can donate money to a fund, and then that's tax deductible for them, and the fund can be used to pay tuition for students.
How effective is something like that?
I don't think that any study has been done, and the question is effective in what respect? Effective in terms of producing better education, effective in helping poor children get access to private schools. It's not clear what the goal is, other than making it more nearly possible for children to go to private schools.
In your book, Privatizing Educational Choice, Consequences for Parents, Schools, and Public Policy, you make a point of saying there are very few for-profit models in the history of our country. Can you elaborate on that?
One of the interesting aspects of the private school is that in the United States, always three quarters or more of the students have been in religiously affiliated schools. So that the purpose of these schools has been more to deal with values and religious principles and things of that sort than to make money for founders. So the history of private schools in the U.S. has been really a not-for-profit phenomenon. In the last decade and a half or so, there's been interest in saying, well, let's start a for-profit organization, and then we'll offer to contract with charter school boards, for example, to run their schools. The best known of these organizations has been Edison Schools. And Edison Schools got a lot of press because of its very strong ambitions. What is most interesting is that as a business model, there are very few of these companies that are actually making profits on running schools. And in some cases, they're making profits because they get into the real estate business and then lease back the real estate to the charter school, and that's where they're making their money. There's one company that's under investigation right now, one of the larger ones, that has been charged with that. So it's a complicated phenomenon, but one of the problems is that these companies have to do a lot of marketing to get customers, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The normal public schools don't have to do marketing. There are other issues that surround them financially, too, and it's noteworthy to basically to note that Edison Schools had about 130 schools, if we go back, oh, let's say 8 years. I think that they're down to about one-third of that number now. And they've gone private. They were a publicly held firm. The stock went up to about $39 and then went down below a dollar so that they were delisted, and then they were sold out privately. But over that course, they lost $650 million, and that's not good for a for-profit firm.
Well, here's what puzzles me. Critics of the spending habits of public school districts are always complaining that too much money is going to the central administration, to the bureaucracies, the administrators. I thought this was supposed to be corrected in for-profit models, such as the Edison Schools. Are you saying this doesn't happen?
Well, we don't have any evidence that it happens. Edison was spending far more per student for its executives, for its lawyers, for its executive headquarters, its accountants. These people are very high-priced, and they have more of them relative to the numbers of clients. And so this is another problem that Edison had. It couldn't get its central office expenditures down to a level where it could be profitable. This is not to say that public schools are perfectly efficient by any means, but it's all relative. And we've now tried a number of different approaches, you know, with the private sector, and we don't have any evidence that the private sector is more efficient, or even we don't have any evidence that the private sector gets better results per dollar.
Well, now, you mentioned Milwaukee and Cleveland. How have those examples, models been going?
Okay, the original Milwaukee model did not allow religious schools to participate, so there wasn't much of a market. Obviously, if 80% of the kids are in religiously affiliated schools and you cut that off, you don't have a lot of competition. Starting in 97, 98, though, the religious schools were allowed. The state courts in Wisconsin, approved the use of funds going to religious schools. Obviously, there was a state constitutional issue, and there's also a federal constitutional issue, but the U.S. Supreme Court said it wasn't going to rule on this case, just leave it alone. And so they have had religious schools participating, and quite a few. I mean, they're up at about 140 schools participating in the voucher market with well over 20,000 students now in Milwaukee. the last 3 years, they have had a very, very rigorous evaluation done with meeting all of these statistical requirements so that you can adjust for the caliber of the students and looking to see which group of schools does better. And there's virtually no difference between the Milwaukee public schools for similar students and the voucher schools. And that's been true now for the evaluations for the last 3 years. They've also balanced the evaluation team so that there are advocates of vouchers on the evaluation team, and there are others who have been less optimistic about them, but both sides with good evaluation skills. But even politically, because this is, as you know, such an emotional issue, an ideological issue, what they've tried to do is to balance those who have written in the past raising questions about vouchers versus those who have been very strongly in favor of vouchers on the same evaluation team.
Uh-huh. My other question then would be, what about international models? In our first program, Chile and the Netherlands were brought up on our program.
Yes. Well, let's talk about both of those. Chile is very interesting because it has had a voucher plan since 1980. And as far as we know, it's the only national and universal voucher plan. It's an interesting plan, and it seems to have worked reasonably well. The state has helped out a lot by helping all of the schools that have gotten poor results. So the state has actually intervened directly, even with private schools, and there were many private schools that were not getting good results, and those results have improved a little bit. But there are some issues surrounding the Chilean plan. The first thing you should know is that the Chilean plan probably has more regulations than any state has for its public schools. So it isn't just schools in the marketplace doing their thing. There is a required curriculum. There is required testing at a national level. There are requirements in terms of the funding beyond the voucher. There are restrictions to schools charging tuition or how any additional fees would be allocated. There are a whole range of restrictions. But if you were to ask, is it effective? It's effective in the sense of freedom of choice. Parents, particularly in the urban areas, have large freedom of choice. In the rural areas, no, because they're too sparse, so there's usually only a public school there. No private schools have come in to compete with the public school because there aren't enough students. And in about a quarter of the municipalities in Chile, there is no competition. The problems that have arisen are twofold. One is that the schools now are more segregated than they've been before by socioeconomic status and income, so that you're seeing poor students in certain schools and left in the public schools, and the students from better-off backgrounds are in schools with children like themselves. The other one is this, that if you ask, well, but has it been effective? Has it really raised achievement relative to what it would have been in the public school system? Chile is now very much a middle-income country. It's been very successful economically. But its test scores on international comparisons are actually lower than comparable countries with comparable levels of income. So the answer is that there's been no obvious impact of the voucher in raising all boats, you know, and making a better system so that everyone does better. Now, one of the answers is that people may not choose schools according to test scores. And the test scores are the currency of these international comparisons. They may choose them for other reasons. They may choose them for religious reasons. They may choose them because they like the style of the school and the pedagogy of the school. So you have to keep that in mind when you ask, is it succeeding? Is it working? Okay?
Well, also, since the emphasis is on funding, the money is still coming from the government?
Yes.
And
parents can add to the voucher, but there are restrictions on how much, and there are also restrictions on what can be done with that funding.
And then the question is it more efficient? In other words, do they have a lower cost per student than, say, the system we have here currently?
Well, you wouldn't want to compare them with the states because we're a much wealthier country and we have much more extensive programs. You know, the U.S. is one of the few countries in the world that has sports programs, that has co-curricular, extracurricular activities. We have one of the most extensive among all countries special education programs, and that's very expensive. We bus, because of the huge expanses of land, we bus about 60% of our students in the U.S. Busing is largely unknown in other countries. So you can't really compare what we're spending in the U.S. directly with what's being spent in other countries unless you make adjustments. And you also want to make adjustments for the more costly education that we have to provide for those coming from immigrant backgrounds, low-income backgrounds. I mentioned already special education, which can be enormously expensive for moderate and severely disabled children. Those are commitments we make, and they do cost money. There's no question about it.
Your mentioning all of these factors makes it clear to us how many components there are to consider and what sort of compromises we'll need to make if we insist upon cuts to the education budget. And, as regards our own experience in the United States with privatizing education, you seem to be saying that the results are not more economical or even more academically productive.
Perhaps that's been the biggest surprise, that market competition doesn't seem to have changed at least the test scores for any given group of students. What it has done is it's provided more options. It's provided choices.
Thanks, Professor Levin, for your valuable contribution to today's discussion of school funding. You are listening to Examining Education. I am your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. I invited Emeritus Professor Walter McMahon to listen to what our previous speakers, Ralph Mortieri and Henry Levin, had to say about how public schools are currently funded and how they should be funded. Professor McMahon is a professor of economics and of educational organization and leadership, both emeritus, at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Welcome to our program, Professor McMahon.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It seems that both of our previous speakers seem to think that the major source of funding must come from the government, some combination of local, state, and federal funding. Ralph Mortieri seems also to feel the answer is more funding and more equitable funding and argued for a higher foundation level. Henry Levin seems to conclude that privatization offers more choices but doesn't appear to be more efficient or more equitable or reduce government involvement. Is this what you got out of their discussions?
I don't specialize in, private schools, but I have read articles in the journals on this, and everything that both Hank Levin said and Ralph Mortieri said squares very much with everything that I know about this subject. I didn't find things to disagree with in anything they said.
Well, were there any other avenues you thought we could have explored in what is and what ought to be in a discussion of funding?
The United States hasn't done as well. It's kind of below the average of the other countries internationally, and there's been lots of discussion of this. Well, this new study breaks down our schools by poverty level, and lo and behold, these schools that are in the top 10%, in other words, who have less than 10% students in poverty, are the best in the world. The OECD average, for example, of 493, way above. And schools that are in the next 10% score 527, way above the OECD average. In other words, all of our schools that are in the top 50%, in the sense that they have less than 50% students in poverty, do extremely well compared to these international ratings of scores. To beat Finland is remarkable. I mean,
but
a score.
Then are you saying, though, that the other countries don't have their poor students?
They don't have as many poor students. The United States has very considerable income inequality. This is part of the cause of the whole thing. In other words, we have poor schools in poor neighborhoods, and this drags the average down.
Why is it that there are fewer impoverished students in schools in those other countries with higher scores than in our country?
Well, one of the causes of this inequality is that we have these very poor schools in the poor neighborhoods. We have great inequality in the funding of our education system, as Ralph Matteri says. He indicated it was highest in Illinois of any state in the nation, which is kind of remarkable. And that is driving the average down. Other countries don't have as much inequality in their income distribution, partly because their funding of their schools is more equal. Major reason is that, but it's also that they've got broader social safety nets of various kinds than we have in the United States.
Wow, so you're saying that poverty is really the problem in this country.
Poverty is really the problem in this country, that's right. And the funding of schools in neighborhoods that have low property tax values, the inequality in the funding system, as Ralph Matteri says, is a serious source of this problem. Incidentally, there's a new national commission that has just been appointed by the U.S. Department of Education, and this is to study equity and excellence. That's the title of the commission, the Equity and Excellence Commission, and it's got as members a number of leading people in the country in this field, and Ralph Matteri is one of them. He's going to be on that commission. And he's stressed, you know, what you do is you need to eliminate the unfunded mandates and you need to shore up the foundation level. So I do think that that point is probably going to be brought to the attention of that commission. Well, and the connection to these PISA scores that I mentioned, which is so strong and so clear.
Thank you so much for being on our show. I think you've added much to our understanding of school funding.
Well, you're welcome.
You've been listening to Program 2 of our series Examining Education. Our topic today was school funding. How are schools funded and how should they be funded? I invite our listeners to go to www.examineducation.org or to our Facebook page, Examining Education, to send us your comments about today's program. Listeners who want to explore this topic further will find additional details and links on our website. The topic of our next program is school curriculum. How is curriculum currently decided, and how should it be decided? We encourage you to send in your suggestions for future topics and future speakers. I am your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley.